Good evening, and welcome to Boston University's World of Ideas. I'm Deborah Becker. Tonight we have a lecture presented by the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Our speaker is widely respected scholar of German idealism and a leader in modern Jewish philosophy, Dr. Miriam Bienenstock. Dr. Bienenstock's lecture is titled Immanuel Levinas in Context, The Jewish Connection. We begin with an introduction by tonight's moderator, Michael Zank, professor of religion and acting director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies.
Welcome, everybody, to the third of three lectures on Levinas, today on the Jewish connection. Our speaker, as before, is Miriam Bienenstock from the University in Tours, in France. She's our guest as a visiting professor in philosophy and Jewish studies. Last week, then, we heard about a German connection, where it turned out that one of the German connections was actually a Jewish philosopher, Franz Rosenzweig, whose work on German idealism, and particularly on Hegel, became an important influence on Immanuel Levinas. There, too, was a poison or a drug, as Miriam likes to say, to be resisted, to be worked against or with, and of course there's a lot of that going around in German philosophy. So thank you, Miriam, for yet another drug, another connection that you will make for us tonight, and without further ado, Miriam Bienenstock.
So, after the French and the German connections, I had announced a lecture on the Jewish connection. I also did that for the sake of parallelism, but it is not sure that the parallel works. The first reason being that Levinas himself would not have been happy with such a title. Certainly not with the association to a drug, a drug we would get addicted to and from which we would need to free ourselves. That Levinas would have objected to the expression does not necessarily mean that we have no right to use it, but the fact itself should be accounted for, also its implications when dealing with the topic. Another question arises out of such a title. How should one understand the predicate Jewish in the expression Jewish connection? That predicate is not comparable to French or German, never mind how those predicates are to be defined, whether as referring to a country or to a state or as a nationality under whichever definition of that term. In the early lecture by Levinas and Rosenzweig, which I have already abundantly used last week, Levinas has quite an extraordinary sentence. Judaism, he says, is not, I quote, just a teaching whose thesis can be true or false. Jewish existence, and I write existence as one word, he says, Jewish existence itself is an essential event of being. Jewish existence is a category of being, end quote. What an extraordinary statement. When many years ago I first read that text, which is reproduced in the collection entitled Difficile Liberté, I did not pay much attention to it. It belongs to a lecture Levinas had been giving during a conférence d'intellectuels juifs de langue française, organized in 1959 for the Congrès Juif Mondial. And almost at the end of the lecture, Levinas had been insisting that, I quote, the great stumbling block Judaism encounters today would not even have been evoked in the papers he had heard during this conference. No Jew today can ignore that what is put in question by events and ideas is the very fact that he is a Jew. Judaism might not last anymore, Levinas had said. That had confirmed my hypothesis that what he had wanted had been to fight against assimilation, mixed marriages, etc., but that there was not much more to be made of his statement. But it so happens that questions about the uses of the word Jew and the ranges or scope of the word Jew keep reaching the headlines, more particularly in France. I'll give just one example out of many. A few years ago, as I was preparing the Rosenzweig Congress, which took place in Paris in 2009, I came across a fairly recent publication directed by Alain Badiou, quite a well-known figure in France, also abroad. The publication dates from 2005. It had aroused quite a controversy in France in those years because it included an article bearing as a title that very expression I have just tried to translate into English. Portée du mot juif, ranges of the word Jew. The author of the article, a lady by the name of Cécile Winter, was claiming there that that word, le signifiant juif, was one which was venu d'Hitler, which had come from Hitler, and that it would have become unpronounceable, impronounceable, that it should therefore be, I quote, deliberately put aside, délibérément mis de côté. We are back to the French connection, then. The thesis asserted here is a typically French thesis, and it has quite a pedigree in France. It is nothing else in the final instance than the famous conception of Sartre in his Réflexions sur la question juive of 1946. A Jew is un homme que les autres hommes tiennent pour juif, a man that other men consider as Jew. A Jew. Cécile Winter aims today at other targets than Sartre after World War II, but the line of her argument is exactly the same. It is the other man or the other woman who calls me names, the other who gives me a name and thereby my identity. And this is hell. L'enfer, c'est les autres. Hell, this is the others. We must endeavor to get out of hell. We cannot stay there, admittedly. Whatever one may think about these arguments, they do have the advantage of rendering Levinas's own intellectual itinerary very clear. Also, for that matter, Rosenzweig's, for it is interesting to note that Rosenzweig, from whom Levinas says that he borrowed the amazing category thesis I have just cited, that Jewish existence is a category of being, Rosenzweig himself had not always stuck to that thesis. He had gone very far in the opposite direction, even proclaiming at one point, only in a letter to his parents to be sure, but this might also be relevant, that, I quote, when a Jew, the Jew as I understand him, that is the Jew of religion, is attacked, he must not hold the Torah before himself as a shield. He rather belongs in the first place to the Torah. It's not the Jews who ought to be preserved, it is Judaism. That's Rosenzweig. It's not the Jews who ought to be preserved, it is Judaism. That letter had been written many years before the Shoah. It is dated November 6, 1909, and Rosenzweig died before Hitler came to power. Rosenzweig would probably not have dared to write the same extreme sentence after the Shoah. But this is the question at stake. Is it anti-Semitism and is it the Shoah which defines the Jew? Neither Rosenzweig before World War I nor Levinas after the Shoah had been ready to accept that thesis, which is the thesis of Jean-Paul Sartre. It also was in order to show how wrong, how meaningless that thesis was, that both Rosenzweig and Levinas had turned back to what they called Judaism. Their ways to Judaism had been different, though, for there had been a break, even several breaks, in Rosenzweig's life, whereas Levinas denies that there ever was one, an interruption in the path which he followed. He says that he was quite often very busy with all those new teachings he had had to appropriate, other languages, philosophy, Christian theology, and that he had then repeatedly told himself that he ought not to forget his own inner substance, the Jewish one, and the texts it was made of. And then he adds that he had been lucky enough later on, after World War II, to meet exceptional people, people who did have a high Jewish culture and who had induced him to get more thoroughly interested in Jewish studies. One of these people has been Shushani. It was quite appropriate then to post as advertisement for this third lecture of mine three photos of Shushani. This teacher of Levinas certainly did play an important role in leading Levinas to what I have called the Jewish connection. But before turning to the substance of my talk, let me also evoke another figure, one which is, I reckon, only very indirectly, if at all, connected to Shushani and to Levinas, but which might nevertheless be considered symbolical in many ways of Levinas' central but enigmatic conception of the human face. I am referring here to the figure and the face of Marcel Marceau. Le mime Marceau. Many do not know that Marcel Marceau, his real name was Marcel Mengel, had been related to the very community Shushani seems to have frequently been host to in Strasbourg. A quite small shtiebel, a community of strict obedience to which many Jews of Polish origin belonged before the Second World War. Many of those have been deported, amongst them Marcel Marceau's father, who had been the kosher butcher, the shochet of the community. Isn't it extraordinary to discover that the son, Marcel Marceau, became a mime and spent his whole life hiding behind a white mask, hiding like Shushani, in a sense. You see that instead of performing a kind of striptease with Levinas and undressing him, I would rather place him under a new veil, under a mask. Il avance masqué, as one says in French. He advances under a masked face. He expresses himself ad captum vulgi, paying attention to that which his readers can understand. Ve hamevin yavin. Only some of them, not everybody, will understand. This would be the one first reason for which I am presenting here the face of the mime Marceau. His play and his face became world famous, but he was incredibly masked. And then he never talked on stage. But his figure and his face are extraordinarily eloquent. His face speaks or talks. But is it the face which speaks or talks? What is there in a face which talks? Well, I leave it to you to say if the comparison with Marcel Marceau is pertinent or not, and I shall also turn back to this question later on to say why or in which sense I think that it is. However that may be, one should listen to that which Levinas says in that interview I have been quoting from. He says that the history of the Shoah certainly played a much greater role for his Judaism than Shushani. But that Shushani did give him a renewed confidence in what he calls the books, meaning probably Sfarim. And then he evokes Buber, and his indignation about Buber, who would have put conscience before the books, as if Buber's own moral conscience knew better than the books. I shall first examine that connection of Levinas to Buber. This will be an inner Jewish connection, which will lead me to examine several, or at least one key concept of Levinas's thought, whose translation and meaning seem problematic, and which will also lead me to authors more rarely taken into account in connection with Levinas, authors who, however, might have been quite influential upon the development of his thought and some of his basic ideas. I am more particularly thinking of Jacob Gordin, but also of Hermann Cohen. The text of Buber Levinas refers to in that interview, in which he says that the history of the Shoah certainly played a much greater role for his Judaism than Shushani, but Shushani would have given him a renewed confidence in the books. That text is about a meeting Buber seems to have had once with a very pious old Jew who was questioning him about a verse of Samuel 1:15. The prophet Samuel, Levinas says, I quote, tells King Shaul he should erase from the map and from history the kingdom of Amalek, which in the biblical and Talmudic tradition incarnates radical evil. That's Levinas. Hadn't Amalek been first in cowardly attacking the Israelites? And then Levinas quotes Deuteronomy 25:12 or 19, depends upon the notation. When the Lord your God gives you rest from all the enemies around you in the land he is giving you to possess as an inheritance, you shall blot out the name of Amalek from under heaven. Do not forget. Timche et zecher Amalek mitachat lashamayim lo tishkach. But King Saul didn't obey. He spared the life of King Agag of Amalek. And then the Israelites took the best of the sheep for them to bring to God in sacrifices. Samuel reacted by himself killing King Agag on the spot. Question to Buber. Here I'm quoting Levinas. Question to Buber coming from the very old pious Jew. How could he, Samuel, ever do that? Answer of Buber, the prophet had not understood that which was requested from him by God. Then Levinas, Buber probably thought that his conscience informed him better than the books on God's will. And how comes he did not read in Samuel 1:15-33, as your sword has made women childless, so will your mother be childless amongst women. Then Levinas adds, I do not always agree with Buber. I go on believing that one cannot obey conscience without giving an extreme attention to the book of books. Buber there did not think of Auschwitz. The stand Levinas adopts here on the question raised by the memory of the Shoah is in many ways different from the stand commonly adopted today on this question, particularly in France. If only because when today we deal with that duty, which is commonly called duty of memory, we very rarely, if ever, refer to the Hebrew Bible, at least never explicitly. Isn't it astonishing, though? Wasn't the duty to remember in the first place a biblical injunction? Remember you were slaves in Egypt and that God redeemed you. But then France, the country in which Levinas lived, has always been prone upon defending that which is called their laïcité, badly translated by secularism. There also are many other reasons for which the Bible is not evoked. The first one being that in the Bible, and more particularly in the Ten Commandments, the injunction to remember is formulated as a particularistic one. It is an injunction specially addressed to the Israelites. It is not universalistic. And in our days, we have difficulties handling an ethics which would be particularistic. Is it an ethics at all, or would it rather be a religion? We do distinguish today between religion and morality, between religion and ethics, particularly in France, also between morality and politics, morality and law, but no such distinctions existed in the Hebrew Bible, which did not distinguish between that which is religious, that which is political or juridical, the juridical obligation, and that which belongs to morality proper. These huge differences explain, at least partly, why the question of the duty to remember is so rarely related, if ever, to the Hebrew Bible, the Ten Commandments, or to the so-called particularistic duty of remembering and or blotting out Amalek. It also is broadly assumed that it would have been through Jesus and through Christianity that a universalistic dimension would have been injected into the particularistic ethics put forward in the Hebrew Bible. In this series of lectures I'm now giving here in Boston, I am so happy to be able to do so, I have not planned a lecture on the Christian, or for that matter, Catholic connection of Levinas' thought. There should have been one, though. It would ought to have been the third one before the lecture on the Jewish connection. But there was no more time, so you'll have to invite me again so that I have the opportunity to talk about that. Still, let me say a few words already now on the Catholic connection and on the opposition, which is so widespread today, of the universalistic morality preached by Christianity to the particularistic ethics allegedly put forward in the Hebrew Bible. The formulation is, I think, very misleading, if only because an ethics with universalistic features can already be found in the Hebrew prophets. This point has been emphasized by many Jewish thinkers, amongst them Mendelssohn and Hermann Cohen, and also by Christian theologians already in the 19th century. And it should be noted that it also is in the tradition of these thinkers who emphasized biblical prophetism that Levinas replaced himself very explicitly. To him, the prophetic vision was based upon an awareness of, I quote, the whole of humanity in the eyes that look at me. L'humanité tout entière dans les yeux qui me regardent. I'll come back to this point later on in my lecture. But the basic question here about the duty to remember is another one. It is that of determining if this duty, which is an important part of the Ten Commandments, is to be considered as a moral obligation or rather as a political one. And in this latter case, it's that which we call in France a loi mémorielle, a law of memory. And I would like to point out here that the debate on such laws, their status and their content, is in France up to this day very actual, even hectic. Should we consider the duty to remember as a political duty, a duty imposed by a law, or as a moral one? Whichever option we'll adopt, it is worth noting that Levinas himself did distinguish between morality proper and that which he considered as a fight for justice, a fight which he deemed political. Also, he knew very well that when one turns the duty to remember into a political rather than a moral obligation, one does not necessarily weaken the imperative. One may well make it much, much stronger. Contrarily to what is often believed, referring to universally valid categorical moral imperatives obligates to much less than laws or other obligations. Political obligations, obligations inscribed in laws, may well be particularistic, binding only for the citizens of a specific state at a certain time, contrarily to those moral obligations which we consider today as universalistic in nature, but they nonetheless obligate, sometimes also to violence. Levinas was no pacifist. He rather argued that in certain cases, violence, I quote, violent action against evil is necessary. Levinas thus wanted to tell Buber, who had been, so it seems, horrified, in any case dismayed, at discovering while reading the Hebrew Bible that the prophet Samuel had personally hacked King Agag the Amalekite to death, that one cannot obey conscience without giving an extreme attention to the Book of Books. Levinas agreed with Buber on many points. He repeatedly paid tribute to him, also with regard to the way in which Buber read the Bible, which, according to him, was new. And then Buber would never say the Torah, but quite correctly, the teaching, l'enseignement. He would never say the law, but teaching again, which would be completely correct. Levinas agrees with all this, also with the statement that if one wants to understand that which is said in the Hebrew Bible, one ought to learn Hebrew. But then he adds that Buber always stayed within the tradition of religious liberalism. Buber had wanted to make room for biblical criticism and for Spinoza, a consideration which is not necessarily to be rejected, Levinas says. Still, Buber had also omitted, just like Spinoza, the Talmudic contribution. And at this point, Levinas does not agree anymore. It is interesting to note that Levinas always remains very cautious in his criticism of Buber himself, also in his examination of Buber's ideas. He notes, for example, that for Buber, living religiously, I quote, never meant living according to a religion, that this was never identical with that which he calls mystical enthusiasm, and I quote, filled with enthusiasm possessed by a god, the personal soul goes astray. The contact of the divine with the exalted instance is for Buber meeting, dialogue, opening to others, but at the same time presence to self. The instant is not transcended in the impersonal, but in the interpersonal. Persons who speak to one another, confirm one another, unique and irreplaceable. In this, there is faithfulness on Buber's part to a tradition characteristic of Jewish mysticism itself. The mystic never speaks to himself in the second person as if he had entered into God, as if the moth that circled the fire were burned by the fire. Never coincidence, always proximity. Resistance of Judaism, says Levinas, to any apotheosis of man as to an incarnation of God. Enthusiasm is not the purest way in which to enter into a relationship with God. The term enthusiasm, in Hebrew itla avut, is the very word used by mystical adepts to Hasidut in order to describe the state of mind a Hasid might reach through his prayers, also that he should have in daily life. And indeed, one finds in the popular forms of Hasidut, Buber himself, when he described such a state of mind, referred repeatedly to ecstasy. Would we have to deal once again with the drug? For us to identify that Jewish drug, Levinas would have wanted to get rid of, but to which he might also have fallen prey, at least partially, for us to identify in other terms that which might well be called the Jewish connection of Levinas's thought, there is no better way than recurring to the title Levinas himself chose for one of his early articles. The Pharisee is absent. In that article, which was first published in 1959 in the journal Information Juive, then again in 1963 in the collection Difficile Liberté, Levinas did not use the term Pharisee in order to describe precise historical phenomena. He resorted to it polemically. But then, this is exactly what interests me here. The Pharisee, with whom Levinas does seem to identify, is somebody who resists and objects to drugs. Which ones, then? Levinas, who indicts this famous prayer spoken aloud, which, according to the wise men of Israel, is the very manifestation of false prophecy, and who argues that false prophecy, I quote, already reverberates around the public square and at our meetings, criticizes a Jewish revival which would operate, I quote, under the sign of the irrational, the numinous, or the sacramental. In my last lectures, I related these categories to Rudolf Otto and his book Das Heilige, and also to studies in ethnology and sociology which had been developed at the time and which were quoted by Levinas. But it cannot be doubted that in the article out of which I am quoting, Levinas wants to indict first and foremost Jewish circles. Admittedly, not Buber himself, but certainly some circles linked to Hasidism. The reference to the notion of enthusiasm makes this unambiguous. It would be quite possible to precisely identify those circles he was talking about, but I would say that such an attempt does not have much interest, if only because things have considerably changed since those days. Today, Levinas might feel closer to Hasidic circles and want to keep at a distance from some of those we would bring nearer to those whom he called Pharisees. Political programs are related to specific times and countries, and they do vary, contrarily to moral ideals, which are said universal. What about religion, though? Or rather Judaism, the term religion being one which Levinas never liked when Judaism was concerned. Well, there are other terms which might be more appropriate, also according to Levinas, for describing Judaism and the Pharisee. Levinas quotes, here I quote him, holiness, that is, separation or purity, the essence without admixture that can be called spirit and which animates the Jewish tradition. In this sentence, Levinas gives four terms, which according to him describe Judaism: holiness, separation, purity, and spirit. The fifth one being that of Pharisee itself. What are the biblical Hebrew terms Levinas had in mind when he talked about separation? I have referred to the Pharisees, but there are others, amongst them that of holiness itself, kadosh, kdusha, which in Hebrew also means separation. Not just in Hebrew, though, that which is sacred, sacer in Latin, also is that which is separated. And then there are other words in Hebrew which mean separation. Havdalah, lehavdil, for example. In the new Hebrew translation of totality and infinity, the French term séparation is translated as hafrada, quite innocuously. But then the French word also is totally innocuous. Somehow. Let us take the section of totality and infinity entitled Séparation et discours. Here is what Levinas says. The relationship of language implies transcendence, radical separation, the strangeness of the interlocutors, the revelation of the other to me. In other words, language is spoken where the common plane is wanting or is yet to be constituted. It takes place in this transcendence. It is usually argued by philosophers, that's what I think at least, that for any language to be possible, a common plane would be needed, something common between interlocutors. Levinas completely reverses the argument. Language, he says, rather presupposes the absence of a communal plane and a radical separation. And it will be language which will institute a communal plane and a communal world. It is language which accomplishes the putting in common, which puts in common a world hitherto mine. The basic formulation of the call at the basis of Rosenstock's and Rosenzweig's conception, I quote, instead of Descartes' sentence, cogito ergo sum, I think, therefore I am, the following grammatical proposition must therefore be introduced. God has called me, therefore I am. I am given a proper name, therefore I am. The conception of language and of the subject, the human subject which Levinas developed in his work, was indebted to that of Rosenzweig. We know what Levinas said at the very beginning of Totality and Infinity, that Rosenzweig was too often present in his book to be cited. Indeed, he was. It is the other human being, also the other with the capital O, the other as God, who calls me, who gives me a proper name, and thereby my identity, but also thereby a calling, a mission, who enjoins me to behave in a certain way, to accomplish certain deeds, and not to accomplish other ones. That the other, our parents, also our friends and neighbors, those we are connected to in society, call us in a certain way, give an identity to us, this is not hell, as Sartre had said, and it is not a situation we should, or for that matter, ought to extract ourselves from. It rather is that which would give its meaning, an ethical religious meaning, to our life. These points ought to be further developed, and I cannot do it here, but I would like to try and underline the singularity of that well-known teaching, which is often considered as central to Levinas's conception, but is so difficult to understand. While being fully aware of the paradox, the Mime Marceau did not speak, whereas for Levinas, a face always speaks. The vision of the face is inseparable from language. But then one should pay attention to the fact that there are many ways of talking, many languages which do not correspond at all to that relationship of language Levinas was referring to. And then one may well speak, communicate a message by gestures rather than by words. Bodily gestures can speak much better than words. From that point of view, the rapprochement with the Mime Marceau is quite adequate. Regarde, il dit tout, et il cause pas. Look, he says everything and he doesn't babble. The Mime Marceau spoke with his whole body, not just with his face, which for that matter was covered by a white mask. You didn't see it. This could be another difference, which would render my rapprochement inappropriate. But do you ever see a face? Probably not. And this might just be the experience Levinas would have wanted to convey. The term vision rather evokes or calls for another association than that of merely seeing, and another kind of language or speech than mere talk. Levinas refers to prophetic speech, the speech of the Hebrew prophets. It is the prophetic word the world of justice, which according to Levinas responds to that which he calls the epiphany of the faith. It is from that point of view that the rapprochement with the Mime Marceau would perhaps not be quite appropriate. But other connections and other sources, perhaps also other languages, might be required to decipher that which does seem to remain in many ways quite enigmatic. Why did Levinas so strongly insist upon the face? Why did he put such a strong accent upon seeing? The face, un visage, this is what one may call in German Gesicht. The term Gesicht, which is commonly used for denoting a face, has Sehen as its roots. It also denotes vision, that which one sees by opposition to our other senses, senses of hearing or of touch, for example. That term is used, or rather it was used in the past, for today this use seems to be obsolete, to denote an intellectual vision, an idea in the Platonic sense of the term. Hermann Cohen resorts to this latter meaning of the term in one of his earliest articles, Die Platonische Ideenlehre, Psychologisch entwickelt. When reflecting upon the meaning of Plato's discovery, the discovery of the idea, he evokes those works of art, of sculpture, the Greeks excelled in creating, thereupon also explicitly calling upon the biblical language, which refers to a vision, Gesicht. The Hebrew word he would then have in mind, probably being that of Chazon, I would think. The link to ethics and to prophetic justice, one which would be universalistic and encompass the human species as a whole, renders this source and Hermann Cohen as a source of Levinas quite inescapable. It must have been through Jacob Gordin that Levinas learned about Hermann Cohen and about his ideas. Jacob Gordin was a Russian scholar who, after having written a thesis on Hermann Cohen at the Berlin Akademie für die Wissenschaft des Judentums, got settled in Paris, where he worked as a librarian at the Alliance Israélite Universelle. Gordin was the animating soul behind the Jewish revival Levinas is talking about in Difficile Liberté, a revival Levinas believed he could observe in France after the war, more particularly at the so-called École d'Orsay, which flourished after the Second World War. There were different branches, different orientations in that school, and it must be added that Levinas seldom participated in the sessions. Once he gave as a reason the fact that the school had been strongly marked by the Jewish scouts, the AEF, and up to this day, a flourishing youth movement in France, and that he himself was no scout. But this may not have been the true reason. It is quite possible that Levinas did not agree with some of the orientations of the leaders. However that may have been, it undoubtedly was through Jacob Gordin that Levinas learned to know Hermann Cohen's writings. The references to Cohen run throughout Levinas's works, and although Levinas rules Hermann Cohen out on several occasions, he does resort to him on major issues. One example I would give, but there are many others, is what he says about justice, prophetic vision, and the face, or Gesicht. It is Cohen who inspires Levinas on the question of justice. The most appropriate conclusion to that lecture on the Jewish connection, and for that matter, to the series of lectures I have given and have had so much pleasure giving, the most appropriate conclusion should lead us in another direction and to another author. an author to whom I intended to devote a special lecture, if not a conference, a colloquium, Spinoza, or what may be called the Spinoza case. Just a few words on that now. Levinas published an article with that title, The Spinoza Case, in 1955-1956. It seems that in those years he had wanted to take part in a discussion Ben-Gurion, then president of the State of Israel, had launched. Wasn't it high time to lift the cherem, the anathema against Spinoza? Levinas did not agree. He did not deny some of Spinoza's achievements, more particularly those related to biblical criticism. And the point deserves to be strongly emphasized. Levinas said that biblical criticism does not wound anything. The text would not need any external support, certainly not that of a so-called revelation, to evince their importance. And then Levinas goes as far as arguing that the texts are the more miraculous, the more one discovers that they consist of numerous and disparate fragments. Moses may well not have been the sole author of the Bible, and Spinoza had not been the first to say that. Others had put forward similar arguments long before him. But the rabbinical tradition, that tradition Spinoza had chosen to ignore, had known how to make sense of those fragments. The reason for which the cherem had been edicted against Spinoza did not lie there in biblical criticism. And then Levinas says, I quote, "We entirely agree with the opinion of our late lamented and admirable friend Jacob Gordin. Spinoza was guilty of betrayal." The reason being that, that's what Levinas says, within the history of ideas he subordinated the truth of Judaism to the revelation of the New Testament. On the same page, he also invokes Hermann Cohen, who, I quote, when asked by a Christian if he did not long for Jesus, would have quoted the psalm, "The Lord is my shepherd, I shall not want." There is lurking behind these sentences a whole connection. Levinas does not explicate, although it would most certainly need to be brought to light. But il avance masqué. He pays attention to that which his readers can accept. He writes, "et captum vulgi," thereby following a line which had already been indicated by Leo Strauss, whom Levinas also quotes in another of his articles on Spinoza, without, however, adding any further comments. It must have been with Jacob Gordin that Levinas discussed Spinoza. With Gordin, who, as Levinas once said, had been infatuated with Marburgian neo-Kantianism, that is, with Cohen. Both may well have discussed Cohen's fierce opposition to Spinoza, and then they had discovered that they both agreed, that they entirely agreed with Cohen in his condemnation of Spinoza. Why? Much could be said on this, but I'll just add a few words here to remind you that Cohen, who had once himself been enthusiastic about Spinoza, did acknowledge, up to the very end of his life, that the Tractatus had been a grounding stone in the fight for political religious liberalism, and that it had been instrumental in promoting enlightenment religiously and politically. Even in 1915, in the fiercest of the articles he wrote against Spinoza, Cohen said that this merit of Spinoza ought to be acknowledged ungeschmälert, undiminished. And yet, Cohen had risen against him. Amongst the many points of criticism he had raised against him, there also was the reproach that Spinoza had refrained from applying to the New Testament the rules of biblical exegesis he had formulated for the Old Testament, and that he had put Jesus about above Moses, but I do not think that this was the real source of his discontent with Spinoza, or that it was, for that matter, the real source of the discontent of Levinas and or of Jacob Gordin against Spinoza. The much stronger reason for Cohen being infuriated with Spinoza's Tractatus certainly was that Spinoza had reduced Hebrew prophecy to a political matter, purely political, not a moral, ethical one, even going as far as arguing that one day, I quote, if occasion offers, so changeable are human affairs, the Jews, I quote, may even raise up their empire afresh, and that God may a second time elect them. So you see why Ben-Gurion was pleased. As for Levinas, it may have been the image of the Jews, and more particularly that of the Pharisee given by Spinoza, an image which has been extremely influential, which disturbed him most. But Levinas does not explicitly say so. He seems to have been hiding, once again, perhaps rightfully so. So I thank you for your attention.
This is Boston University's World of Ideas. You've just heard a lecture by Dr. Miriam Bienenstock. Dr. Bienenstock's lecture was titled Immanuel Levinas in Context, The Jewish Connection, and was presented by the Boston University Center for the Humanities, the Institute for Philosophy and Religion, and the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. Tonight's moderator was Michael Zank, Professor of Religion and Acting Director of the Elie Wiesel Center for Judaic Studies. For a CD of Boston University's World of Ideas, call 1-800-909-9287. That's 1-800-909-9287. You may also go to our website, wbur.org, to hear archived editions of this and all other WBUR programs. Tonight's program was produced by Mike Toda and Michael Garth with help from James Trout. The executive producer of Boston University's World of Ideas is Peter Lydotes. I'm Deborah Becker. Thanks for joining us.